many men of abusing her over the years.
Yeah, and she was actually asked directly about Trump in a 2016 deposition. What did she say? What has she said on the record about him?
So she gave a deposition in 2016, which I believe was in the civil case against Ghislaine Maxwell, where she was asked if she believed Mr. Trump had witnessed the sexual abuse of minors. And she said, I don't think Donald Trump participated in anything. This is also something Maxwell herself repeated in a lengthy interview with Trump's Deputy Attorney General and former lawyer, Todd Blanche. She said, you know, Trump never witnessed anything, never participated in anything. So while these aren't the first allegations that an Epstein victim might have also been abused by Trump, it's the first time we've kind of seen them laid out like this in emails.
And that was the chief US correspondent for The Times and Sunday Times, Josie Ensor, speaking to Manveen Rana. You can hear all about what's in these emails, the Epstein-Trump emails, on today's episode of The Story. Find it free wherever you get your podcasts. That's pretty much it from me for today. Indeed, for this week, it's been a real pleasure being here at The Times at One. I'll be back soon. Thanks for listening. I'm leaving you in the safe hands of Fee and Rosie.
Across the UK, on DAB digital radio, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Stephen, thank you. Good afternoon. It is 2 o'clock. You are listening to Fee Glover and me, Rosie Wright, in for Jane Garvey this week on Times Radio.
Coming up over the next 2 hours, a devastating litany of failures is laid bare by a report on the murder of the 10-year-old Sara Sharif. We'll hear more from Ben Ellery, the Times' deputy chief reporter, in just a moment. The US government shutdown is over, with Donald Trump hailing it as a big win, but probably in caps. But could revelations about the president's relationship with the paedophile Jeffrey Epstein bring him back down to earth? We're also on the programme going to talk about the £220 phone bag that looks suspiciously like a sock. And our big interview after 3:30 is with the singer and actress Petula Clark.
A sock with a handle, I'd say. First, though, let's get the latest news with Stuart Willey.
Rosie, thank you. Good afternoon. Sir Keir Starmer says he will absolutely deal with anybody responsible for briefings against ministers to the media. The Prime Minister is facing calls from senior members to sack those behind rumours that his health secretary was plotting a leadership coup. Last night, he apologised to Wes Streeting over the backlash. The PM insists he's on top of the situation.
I've been talking to my team today. I've been assured that no briefing against ministers was done from number 10, but I've made it clear that I find it absolutely unacceptable.
Police and crime commissioners in England and Wales are being scrapped by the government. The elected officials were first introduced in 2012 and are responsible for setting forces' budgets and appointing chief constables. Ministers insist the savings will be invested into more neighbourhood policing, but Shadow Home Secretary Chris Philp says that won't scratch the surface.
This government, essentially, in their announcement today, is tinkering around the edges. They are rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic, while crimes like shoplifting rocket, while police numbers fall, and while the police face a funding crisis made in the Home Office.
A report into the death of Sara Sharif, who was murdered by her father and stepmother in Surrey, has found racial sensitivity was one reason her abuse wasn't uncovered. The independent review concluded she was failed by the safeguarding system, finding numerous missed opportunities to save her. The 10-year-old girl was found dead in 2023 when her father called police after fleeing to Pakistan. Surrey County Council says it's taken robust action to address failings. The chief executive is Terence Herbert.
Sarah's death is absolutely devastating. The criminal proceedings resulted in some justice for Sarah, and the people that are responsible for her murder are rightly facing long prison sentences. Although the report does not find a single solution to address all the factors that affected Sarah or hold any one organisation accountable, there are important recommendations from many different agencies.
Economic growth slowed to 0.1% in the third quarter of the year, below expectations. Official figures also show the economy declined in September by the same proportion after the cyber attack on Jaguar Land Rover hit manufacturing. The waiting list for routine hospital treatment in England has fallen slightly, having previously risen 3 months in a row. According to the NHS, 6.24 million patients were waiting at the end of September, 10,000 fewer than in August. Some of the biggest names in music, including Coldplay, Dua Lipa and Radiohead, are urging the government to ban ticket touts from operating. Labour pledged before the election to ensure fans weren't priced out of events. Stars are teaming up to demand ministers keep their promise to cap resale prices. And The Times and The Sunday Times has won a series of journalism awards, including Political Journalist of the Year for Stephen Swinford. The newspapers were declared National News Organization of the Year as well at the Society of Editors Media Freedom Awards. For a roundup of the news on demand, find The Times News Briefing on the Times Radio app.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. Weekday afternoons on Times Radio with Wickes Kitchens and Bathrooms.
Stuart, thank you very much and good afternoon. It's 4 minutes past two, Thursday. So for the final time this week, you are in the company of Fee Glover and me, Rosie Wright, sitting in for Jane. So over the next couple of hours, Donald Trump is getting pulled deeper and deeper into the Epstein drama. The tragedy of young women trafficked and abused by Epstein is becoming impossible for Donald Trump to suppress. We'll see what those latest documents reveal. A couple of questions we're going to try and answer as well. What can be achieved at COP30 as it's underway in Brazil? And why has the government's go for growth strategy stuttered so spectacularly? Also, Jane Mulcairns will be here for a dive into the Saturday Times magazine featuring this week One Day and White Lotus star Leo Woodall and an interview with the full-time faithful former England rugby player Joe Marlon with all the details of the scenes behind the scenes of Celebrity Traitors, including how he wasn't paid the same as everyone else and had to reluctantly then spend some of that cash on new clothes. Shorts, he was told, were not appropriate for the final. And talking of unnecessary clobber, Harry Kind is going to be here to review the completely ludicrous £220 iPhone sock cum bag that's been launched for you to show off your even more expensive phone. What other tat are we all guilty of buying? And our big interview at 3:30.
So it is one that Jane has done earlier, but I can tell you these fascinating facts about Petula Clark. She's got the longest career of any British entertainer. She first stepped onto the stage as a child during World War II, singing to the troops. Her biggest hit by far is Downtown, if we spool forward to 1965, when that was released. But in the meantime, she had also become the most popular female singer in France in the 1950s, having married a Frenchman called Claude Wolf. Of course he was. She's won 2 Grammys and sold 100 million records worldwide. She's 92 and her biography, Is That You, Petula, is out now. So you can hear more of her story with Jane after 3:30. Most read stories on the Times website so far today, Rosie.
Number 3, Epstein email claims Andrew photo with Virginia Giuffre is real. The photograph of Andrew Mountbatten-Windsor with his arm around a 17-year-old Virginia Giuffre was real, according to newly released emails sent by the convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. We'll look at that in more detail in an hour's time. The second most read story is where we're going to start our programme today. The headline is Sara Sharif, chances to prevent her murder were lost to racial sensitivities. Professionals failed to properly investigate why Sara Sharif had started wearing a hijab that hid her injuries for fear of causing offence. That was all prior to then her murder. This is this new report. We'll look at the details in a moment or two. And the most read piece on the Times website is Hitler had a hidden genetic sexual disorder, his DNA analysis reveals. Scientists have sequenced the Nazi dictator's DNA. They found that he had Kallmann syndrome, which hinders normal puberty and the development of sexual organs. You can read all of those articles on thetimes.com. You will need your digital subscription. If you don't have one, get one. Go to thetimes.com/subscribe.
Right, shall we start with an incredibly important following. There has been a damning review of the murder of a child. This is Sara Sharif, and the review has found a litany of failures across official bodies. The Surrey Safeguarding Child Partnership said social workers had feared causing offence with questions about the 10-year-old. Sara's father was also given custody of her, despite being a known domestic abuser. Let's talk more with Ben Ellery, who is the chief crime reporter for The Times. Ben, very good afternoon. Just remind us of exactly what happened to this poor, beautiful little girl's life.
Yep, that's right. Sara Sharif was 10 years old when she was found dead at home in August 2023. And what had happened was her father and stepmother had murdered her and fled the country to Pakistan, where her father phoned Surrey police and confessed to killing her, upon which the police went round and found little Sara. She'd suffered huge trauma in the weeks and years before she died. She had over 90 injuries. Her back had been broken 10 times. She'd been burnt, hooded, and her father and stepmother were extradited, and they were found guilty of her murder last year. So now we have a report into what happened.
So this review has been commissioned by the Surrey Safeguarding Children Partnership. Who are they, and what powers have they been able to use here to find out more about the truth?
So, yep, it's an independent review led by two experts who have spoken to various people who were involved in Sara's care. Sara was immediately, upon birth, placed under a protection order because social workers had serious concerns about her mother, her birth mother, and her father. And throughout her life, she was let down by authorities, including a judge who gave custody to her father and eventual murderer, despite being arrested three times for assaulting women and children. The social services, who were afraid to ask questions about why Sara, at 8 years old, was wearing a hijab, despite nobody else in her family wearing one, which was actually being used to cover her injuries. And in fact, the day before her death, they went round, the homeschool team went round to her home, but went to the wrong address because they had an old address on file, despite having been given the correct one. So it's a very sobering read for authorities in Surrey.
Can we just drill down a little bit on some of the things that you've mentioned there? This bar, which was the fear of being seen as racist, it is something that has come up before. Is it a recommendation that needs to be spelt out even clearer? I mean, I'm thinking that, you know, if you went to the home of a child you were concerned about and it was a summer's day and they're wearing a very long sleeve T-shirt, they're wearing a scarf, they're wearing trousers, you know, that's an alarm bell that would ring. How can it still be that social workers don't feel able to ask a really logical question about the state of dress of a child?
Yeah, that's right. And it wasn't just social workers, it was the neighbours as well who were alarmed at her weight. She was malnourished. And the noises that they heard coming from the property next door, and they told the review that they were scared of being accused of being racist, an occupational therapist said the same thing. You know, they didn't want to cause offence. Now, if you speak to actual Muslims in the community, they say that for a young girl to be wearing a hijab when no other women in the family are wearing one, it just doesn't happen. So for no one to actually ask questions when what's at stake here is preventing a child from being abused, you know, really, really is shocking. And the report has made 15 recommendations, one of which is that they need to have experts who can advise them on cultural issues. But, I mean, it has left a lot of people asking, you know, does it really need to be set out as a recommendation? Surely this is, you know, common sense.
And also the common sense surely is just to weigh up the balance of being accused of some form of racism, which you would then be able to say, well, look, actually, this is what I'm trying to do. I am not being racist in asking that question. One of the other recommendations, as you've mentioned, 15 overall from the report, is about an overhaul of homeschooling, because this is an important part of Sara's life, isn't it? She was at school. It was noted at school that she had bruises to her face. And after the teachers had made a notification about one incident of that, she was taken out of school to be homeschooled. And again, alarm bells should ring, shouldn't they?
Well, absolutely. And someone such as Sarah, who's had all of these involvements from authorities in her life, you know, from birth, literally, to be homeschooled, there should be more checks. And that's basically now one of the recommendations, is that within 10 days, a home visit it should be mandatory. But for this to have happened after a teacher spotted bruising, a week later the father rang up the school and claimed that, you know, Sarah had been bullied and he was taking her out of school. And they did the same thing the following year. They spotted three bruises on her face, you know, one the size of a golf ball, and flagged it. And again, taken out of the school system, away from prying eyes of teachers, where, you know, sadly what happened was she was behind closed doors and, as the report says, she became lost.
We also should talk about one point you've already mentioned too, Ben, which is what happened in the family court, because hers was a case that had been known to family courts, and Judge Alison Rayside had praised the quality of one report prepared by an inexperienced social worker. Despite significant gaps, the review said it could be argued that the judge accepted the recommendations without further scrutiny. I think so many people will be so shocked that actually that level of guardrail seems to have failed a child too.
Yeah, that's correct. And actually the judge praised the social worker's report. So, you know, she was able to look at what had been written, which was an experienced social worker, full of gaps. It hadn't properly assessed the stepmother, who'd had a history of difficulties as well, and the judge, Alison Rayside, made this order, which just seems extraordinary. You've got a father who's repeatedly assaulted his children and partners. So for a judge to have done that has been found to have been wanting. The birth mother was not consulted as well. Sarah's birth mother, she also wasn't told that Sarah had been taken out of school. So it really is, when you look at it in the round, just absolutely staggering that all of these dots were not able to be joined up.
Have individuals in this case been held to account for their failures?
Well, no, actually. And the report does not recommend that anyone is sacked. It goes on to say that Sarah's killers were Irfan Sharif and Beinash Patul, you know, which is correct. And, you know, they were convicted of her murder. But the report has not said, you know, this person, you know, needs to be sacked. What happened here was unacceptable.
So what then does happen to these recommendations? What changes?
Well, they'll be reviewed. There are changes that have been recommended for the government, for the council, for the police. The police and the council have come out and said that some of them have been made already. And things like the homeschooling register will now be considered by the government.
There have been so many of these cases, Ben. You would know so much more about them than we probably do, just to name some. And this is by no means an exhaustive list. But Victoria Clumbio, Baby P, Daniel Pelker, Brandon Muir, now Sarah Sharif. And we use the same terminology, don't we? We say a damning report has concluded that it has been a litany of failures. And I think, just judging by the messages we've had in so far since you and I have been talking, so many listeners just feel so angered by a kind of impotence that they feel then follows a really decent report like this. So do you think that there is something now that would make a child in danger's life less vulnerable than it has been in all of those circumstances?
I mean, that's a a fantastic question. And honestly, I don't know. You know, I covered the court case myself. And, you know, listening to the amount of referrals that Surrey Council gets every month, it was over 1,000 that month, I think, when the school contacted them at first. It just leaves you feeling that it, you know, this will happen again, and I'm sure it will. I'm very sad to say, because it is, you know, the worst case court case that I've ever covered. But yeah, it did not. I did not come away from this feeling that you know, we will not sadly see this happen again.
Yeah. And I'm sorry to put you on the spot. There's no reason why you would know the answer to this question. But if there were 1,000 cases referred, I mean, do we know how many social workers those cases were referred to? What's the kind of ratio there?
I'm not sure how many social workers there were, but each social worker was expected to have dealt with 7 cases per day, which I think, you know, is a lot given the complexities of certain cases. And yeah, the report actually says that what should have happened with Sara is that she should have been, she should have gone into foster care. And, you know, perhaps that is something where the authorities are trying to balance keeping a child with their parents and preventing further harm. And, you know, in this case, they've just got it massively wrong.
Yeah, taking them away from danger. Thank you so much for explaining all of that. That is The Times' Ben Ellery. So many of you have got thoughts on this, and we will make time for a collation of them in the next half an hour or so of the programme. It's 19 minutes past two.
And I think one thing that struck me in looking at the report, I think it is so unbelievably shocking to hear that it was so many different authorities, whether that's the courts, the council, the school, who all failed, who all had an opportunity to have intervened. One thing the report mentions is that neighbours were also scared to say something. And I think that's actually where you and me fall into this, that, you know, we too could be guilty of noticing something and then maybe not acting. And the message that comes through is, well, we absolutely must scrutinise the abhorrent failures from the authorities, but to realise actually there is a responsibility for us to look after, or at least look out for, the people on our streets, yeah, as well.
And also, I think that point, and it's a very good point to make, we all play a part, don't we, in our community and the most vulnerable people in our community. But also, we should not be afraid of our ignorance. If you think, I'm not going to ask that question because I might appear to not know enough about somebody's culture, ethnicity, religion, whatever it is, maybe just preface your question by, I don't know enough about this, but, and then ask the question anyway.
Because it was neighbours who also feared being branded as racist on social media. Yeah. They thought there would be some sort of campaign out to get them afterwards. And, you know, what this report has said clearly is, look at the consequence and just weigh up those two things. And then clearly the concern for the child takes precedence. Really, this has been quite a difficult start to the programme. Very important story. We have a little bit of light-hearted joy to come.
Well, and our listeners, you're such good people. You know that we might make a quite a gear change, and you are always happy to make that with us. But we will go back to your texts and messages, because some of them are very thoughtful. And actually, I can feel so much frustration coming through our roller deck of messages this afternoon. So we will convey those.
So coming up before 2:30, what is the most you've paid for something that you suspect might be at the end of the day at Total Tat? Maybe a very large water bottle. I'm sure you've got some examples. This is Fee Glover and me, Rosie Wright, on Times Radio with Wix, the experts in kitchens and bathrooms.
Kate Borsay on Times Radio.
Our newsmaker interview is the influential economist Neil Shearing, whose book The Fractured Age reveals the stark challenges the global economy will face because of changing geopolitics within the next decade. And of course, the biggest stories of the day up for discussion with the journalist and author Rebecca Reed and the communications consultant Liam Deacon.
Kate Borsay, tonight from 7 on Times Radio.
They say man cannot live on bread alone. Well, that's why they invented the toaster. Good job too. Otherwise, Warburtons, who are making this ad, might not have invented their, says here, iconic toasty loaf. And because of their, again underlined, iconic toasty loaf, Warburtons use the best wheat they can, thanks to the long-term relationships they built with their farmers. Good stuff. It's baked in at Warburtons. For more on their bread-angels, give me strength, search Warburtons Good Stuff.
Add water to your will. and know that from that single drop, life will grow. Communities will flourish. A better world will be left. By leaving a gift in your will to WaterAid, you'll help bring essential clean water to people who need it, to change their own lives for generations to come. Add WaterAid to your will. Search WaterAid Legacy to find out how.
Some people think solar only works in summer, but at Hive, we're here to show you solar works all year round, no matter the weather.
Like heavy rain, still working.
Wind,
yeah, still working. Sleet that's basically sideways, you guessed it, still working.
Power is getting the sun to work for you even in winter, helping you to cut your bills and lower your footprint, putting you in control of your energy. Search Hive Solar, know your power.
Can I come down now?
Performance varies by season, weather, roof and system size.
Download the free Times Radio app from the App Store or Google Play today.
Weekday afternoons on Times Radio with Wix Bathrooms, the experts in design and installation. From plumbing and tiling to electrical work, the Wix Bathroom Installation Service can take care of everything. Start your journey today by booking your free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
24 minutes past two. Now, receiving a new pair of socks for Christmas is a tradition for many. And now, thanks to Apple, your phone can get in on the Yuletide joy too. They have launched a £220 iPhone holder, intended to act really as just sort of an extra pocket that can be worn in various ways. It's been criticised as simply being a very ridiculously expensive sock. The consumer expert Harry Kind is with us now to discuss the various items companies try to flog to us in the run-up to Christmas. Harry, how would you describe this? I mean, a sock with a handle is my best bet.
Yes, you could be generous and say that it is a single-purpose bag. It is a knitted, full-length, kind of shoulder-strapped item that slips a sock into it. And, you know, on the one hand, you could say this is actually a pretty good deal. Now, bear with me on this. I do think, like, luxury goods are a nonsense. But, you know, the manufacturers of this, the kind of brand on this is a Japanese brand called Issey Miyake. And they make a load of very expensive knitwear. And actually, if you wanted to use one of their socks to make this bag, it would cost you £40 for, you know, at the very least up to £95 for a pair of socks. So we're kind of starting in a bit of a nonsense world anyway when it comes to cost. But then I also think you've got to compare this to the kind of phone cases that you might be able to get for an iPhone from, say, Prada, which cost £280. And I actually found on Harrods there is a phone pouch for an iPhone which cost £2,900. Exactly, right? So we are talking about some crazy stuff. I've managed to actually knock up my own version with a sock. And it is incredibly simple. It really is literally, it is cutting a slit into a sock and it goes very nicely kind of over your shoulder. And I will be kind of selling these maybe on Etsy at a bargain of £120.
Harry's looks like an old hockey sock, which I think you could probably get for a fiver, which is much, yes, much better value.
Oh, that'd smell nice, wouldn't it?
But is there actually a market for this, Harry? Because it does feel like Apple are testing the boundaries of brand loyalty somewhat.
I think so. I think Apple's in a bit of a difficult situation here because they make, in some ways, a luxury product. You know, this is something which has got a massive market for them. They're one of the world's most profitable companies. And, you know, your billionaire oligarchs are using iPhones. So they are having to market to a product to people, the man on the street and the super billionaires. There's no kind of super luxury version. So they do have this kind of clientele that they can sell to, but they're in the weird position where it's only a small part of their clientele. Ideally, they would have the £10,000 iPhone, but there just isn't really the system in place to make that work. Yes. So kind of what they're doing is stealing other people's money here. Like, you know, Prada, they're saying, don't go to this other brand. We will do this in-house. And, you know, they will sell a lot of these socks.
We may feel very pleased that they won't sell one to us, but there is so much Christmas tat and toot that comes out at this time. What might we actually be falling for?
I mean, I do think whenever I see anything that is seasonal themed, a bit of my bar humbug comes out. And not just from the cost of, say, Christmas-themed pyjamas or a Christmas-themed mug, which is going to have no use for, say, 23 out of 24th of the month of the year, right? This is an incredibly expensive product for the amount of time that you use, even if it is cheap from, you know, B&M or Home Bargains. And I'd also say there's these massive kind of environmental costs to a lot of these goods. So I do think those are a bit of a rip-off generally. But the big rip-off of the year, I do think everyone's talking about, are the Labubus. These incredibly expensive little plush figurines that are available for sale. They're a big hit across Asia, and they've been imported into Europe and North America, and have made Pop Mart a huge amount of money for what are effectively some collectible Beanie Babies for the 2020s.
With a very garish smile. I mean, they've passed V-Buy completely.
They have. So oh, I lucky. Don't... Well, I think maybe... Well, I'm definitely too old for them, Harry, but I think maybe my kids are somewhere... I mean, they're 20 and 17, so are they outside of the market? Is it either much younger or... I'm hoping not much older.
So you haven't been petitioned to buy a Labubu either?
No, and I've not seen one. So
you will now.
Yeah, they're Rosie showed me a picture.
They will be everywhere now.
And I was like, yeah, just to go back to the sock for a moment, though, I mean, I do think that it's advertising the fact that you are just a complete muppet. I mean, the idea that you might have a very expensive phone, then in a very expensive sock bag or whatever it is, that just screams to other people there's loads of resale value in both these products if you nick them. I think just it's daft, isn't it?
Oh, it's a very nickable phone case. You know, it is a moped rider's dream.
Isn't it? Because it's elasticated
sock.
And you could just be able to pull it off a shoulder even easier than, you know, than out of someone's hand.
Exactly right. And I'm 100% sure we will see some incredibly impressive fakes of these coming up on the market in time for Christmas.
You've already made yours, Harry. So
well, exactly, yeah. And there will be ones that are, you know, a lot more sturdy than mine, which will look, you know, pretty similar. I actually think at the end of the day, it's probably not a very practical way of carrying a phone, and it won't have a market in that same way as a, you know, a diamond encrusted phone case might have that kind of eye-catching quality to it.
Harry, thank you very much. Harry Kind, consumer expert, and it appears DIYer as well.
Do you fall for these things, Rosie? Be honest. Be your authentic self, please.
I'm very proud that I didn't fall for the Stanley Cup hype, which all of a sudden everyone was walking around with effectively a bucket with a straw in the middle of it. And I'll be on. This is being honest. I was tempted. I flirted with the idea, and now I'm desperately pleased I didn't go for it.
Well, those are daft as well.
They're ridiculous.
You just look so stupid. I thought they were a comedy item when I first saw somebody walking around with them.
No, yeah, it's the younger for me to say this as well. It is the younger generation who are glued to them because they must be hydrated at all times, and they can't possibly have to go and refill their bottles. They've got to do it all in one go.
Yeah, don't get me started on rehydration. I love this from John in Sheffield, who says Apple's new gizmo has been rebranded Phone Dom in my house. We won't be buying one, but Macy, if that diver off the telly can knit one on his new programme. That's Tom Daly, isn't it?
He probably could.
Right, thank you for all of your messages so far. We're going to do a roundup of them after the very latest news headlines, and those come from Stuart Willey.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Fee, thank you. Good afternoon. A damning report into the failings by authorities who came into contact with a murdered 10-year-old says she should never have been placed in the care of her father and stepmother. The review describes the pair as a lethal combination. They killed Sarah Sharif at her home in Surrey in 2023. The government says it's scrapping police and crime commissioners across England and Wales. Instead, ministers say savings of £100 million will be diverted into neighbourhood policing. The Prime Minister says he will deal with anyone briefing against ministers. Sir Keir Starmer says he's been assured it wasn't done from Number 10. The Times' political editor Stephen Swinford says the PM has apologised to the Health Secretary over the claims.
It took over 24 hours from the Times breaking the stories about the briefings to the Prime Minister to actually ring up Wes Streeting and talk to him. But he had a very brief conversation, we're told, and he apologised for the briefings against him. And he said, we are determined to find the culprits, the people that are behind this.
Growth in the UK economy slowed to just 0.1% in the past 3 months. The cyber attack on Jaguar Land Rover hit activity in the manufacturing sector. And cases of online grooming offences recorded by police forces in England and Wales have almost doubled in the last 8 years. More than 7,200 were recorded in the year to March. For a roundup of the news on demand, find the Times News Briefing on the Times Radio app.
This is Times Radio.
No one sees your small business like you do. The feeling when that unexpected big contract comes in. The butterflies. But that's the exciting bit of it being your business. And you wouldn't have it any other way. So breathe it all in. When your business is your life, we exist to help you live. Search O2 Business.
Chase is the digital bank that could boost your savings.
Ooh, tell me more.
When you join Chase, you could earn 4.5% AER variable. That includes a 2% AER fixed boost for 12 months on top of our standard saver rate.
Oh, yeah, nice.
Yep, our savings boost could help you reach your goals, like that once-in-a-lifetime adventure. Get our best easy access saver offer today. Search Chase Boosted Saver. Offer may be withdrawn at any time. 18-plus UK residents available to new current account customers for your first 31 days. Eligibility applies. 4.41% gross. Terms apply.
Here's to the moment. To the places that give you perspective and the people who change that perspective. The curiosity that leads you to the edge of the earth and the joy that meets you there. Silversea brings you closer to the rare, the remote and the remarkable. On spacious yet intimate ships that show you what most miss. Here's to having every reason to celebrate. To finding more. Learn more at silversea.com.
Weekday afternoons on Times Radio with Wickes Kitchens. There's over 70 stunning styles to choose from and great offers too, including the spend and save with up to 50% off kitchen units. Terms and minimum spend apply. Find out more at wickes.co.uk.
We remain 0333 003 2353 this afternoon. Jane and Fee at times.radio is the email address. Let me just do a roundup of so many of your texts this afternoon. Nick says Surrey County Council, and this is all with reference to the Sara Sharif case, is millions in debt and has been plunged into massive and rushed reorganisation to make government simpler for residents, read Save Money. NHS providers told to go into debt to cover redundancies. I'm not sure how much that will help. And this is Surrey County Council that is in the firing line in terms of the services, the social services provided to Sara Sharif. Jan says, I really hope they name the judge, as they have done certain social workers in the past. How on earth did the judge give the father custody with his violent background? Well, the judge is named in the report, Jan. And Paul says, I live near Woking and there is a thriving Muslim community here. I would have thought that there would be personnel within social services who potentially come from that community, and I can't quite understand why the reason of cultural offence has been highlighted as one of the issues for the safeguarding failures in this very sad case. More of those, if you would like to send us a message, please do. We will do them in the next 15 minutes or so. John Pienaar joins us. Hello, John.
Hello, Fee. So, busy, of course, talking about Labour. It's literally impossible to stop talking about Labour just at the moment. I'm going to be talking about, well, is there such a thing as good advice to the Prime Minister that might just help pull him and the government that he leads back from the cliff edge? I mean, not to be helpful, because it's not my job to be helpful to this or any other Prime Minister, but just as a way of trying to understand how things went so very wrong so very quickly. I mean, obviously Liz Truss blew up even faster, but she was at least at the fag end of a long period of the Conservatives.
Do you feel
in
Keir
office.
Starmer is blowing up at the moment?
Do you think that really will? At the moment, you can see and smell the fuse hissing, and the feeling of sort of fatalism seems to be almost receive wisdom almost whoever you talk to, that it's not about whether Keir Starmer is doomed, just when. And the idea that he lacks vision, he has no way and no skill to communicate a vision, but he doesn't have a vision to begin with, that's also pretty much becoming among many, many people receive wisdom. So we're going to be talking about that.
If it's not recoverable. Yeah, well, is it? If it's not recoverable, yeah. What do you think happens?
Well, I mean, that's an easy one. If it's not recoverable, And then the sort of downhill descent keeps on going. You get to the local elections and they're going to be absolutely grisly. And then you'd think any party, including a conventionally historically reluctant to get rid of a leader party like Labour, will be doing that. And you won't find too many people about the place in the sort of political sphere who say, look, he's going to be there at the next election. Now, so that's what we're talking about. And is that necessarily the narrative? And whether it is or whether it isn't, does talking about it help you to understand why on earth they are in this pickle? Also, BBC Story is still with us. And I'm going to be, because tomorrow that letter to Donald Trump has to be delivered, and it's going to be an apology because the chairman of the BBC has said so. So I'm going to be wondering, what do you put in that letter? And I'm going to be talking to a former head of BBC TV News about that.
And obviously quite interesting to hear from the Republicans' point of view what it is that Donald Trump needs for him to feel satisfied. Yeah. So all of that to come a little bit later with John Pienaar from 4 here on Times Radio.
It's going to have to be one of those really excruciating, groveling ones.
Yeah. With lots of adjectives maybe as well.
Yep. Dear Donald, you're so great.
Could they use some caps?
Caps lock on, always caps lock on. The world's temperature is still on track to increase by a disastrous 2.6 degrees, according to a new report. The Climate Action Tracker says pledges from countries gathered at the COP30 summit in Brazil won't stave off global disaster. Well, let's talk to Johanna Guzman, who is a senior lawyer at the Centre for International Environmental Law, and she is at the COP30 climate summit. A very good afternoon from us here in London, Johanna. You're from Fiji yourself, and I wonder whether you could explain to us, we're in a slightly more kind of protected climate here in the UK, aren't we? What would a 2.6 degree increase in temperature mean for your home country?
Thank you so much for having me and for this question. And yes, hello from Belém. I am usually based in Fiji, and those numbers would be disastrous given the direct connection between sea level rise and climate crisis and the growing levels of greenhouse gas. This is truly a life or death situation for many of Pacific Islanders, small island developing states, and particularly atoll nations that are literally 2 meters max above the sea levels.
Right. COP30, where you are at the moment, Johanna, is such an interesting thing to witness, isn't it? Because it is so important on the one hand, but people are so cynical about it on the other. You've got a legal brain on you. Where would you put your belief in its ability to actually deliver something with those two forces at play?
Again, a great question. And, you know, it's still only week one, so you can check back in with some other of my colleagues from around the Pacific, and that might change. But many of us came here with hope because of the recent International Court of Justice advisory opinion on climate change, which clarified the state obligations that countries have.
Now,
Now,
we have just lost the line a tiny bit, Johanna. I wonder whether you could just repeat literally the last couple of sentences, please.
Yes, that we came here with hope because the International Court of Justice advisory opinion states very clearly that 1.5 is the red line limit, that is what we are working towards. And it's not something that is aspirational, but it is the law. And that climate science is now matched with the law, and we need countries to have nationally determined contributions that match that level of ambition. And that is what is important to get.
Sure. But haven't we got to the stage, Johanna, where actually, unless there is some kind of a threat to those countries, you know, you will have to pay, there will be some kind of retribution. The notion that even if an international court tells you you have to do something, you will do it. We've just passed that point. We can see that in the inactivity around climate change from
Absolutely.
Some of the industrial powerhouses.
Yes, and we all know who those are and the issues that those cause. But that's the other thing, is that the court was very, very clear about reparations are owed to countries that have already felt the climate harm, and that international law is applied just as it is, to require that compensation, restitution, satisfaction, all of these things must happen. Now, it is important to see those types of things actually come to fruition in the COP space, that these various agenda items on things like loss and damage, on things like just transition, actually move forward. And it will be a test to see what the world is going to do given these lines. You know, the science is very clear. We have till 2030 to get a lot of this done. And I think should COP30 not deliver as it needs to in line with the climate action that international law requires, we'll see some very interesting developments.
Sure. What do you say to Donald Trump, who is on a good day intransigent about climate change, and on a bad day, he is a man who wants to carry on putting his weight and might behind industries that we know are part of the damage, not part of the solution?
Yes. I would say it honestly, the US and those that are working towards continued climate destruction are not in line with these things, but it doesn't matter what is going to happen, what is continually pushed by certain leaders within countries that are not in line with the climate crisis, because the world's entire community is behind seeing something done. And what we need to see happen is that these kinds of decisions are then put into fruition at those national jurisdiction levels, and that they're pushed within the boardrooms and the, you know, state level sides of things. And that's where I kind of maintain the hope.
Yeah.
That even when you have these big headliners doing stuff like that, it's this, those on the ground, you know, at the community level, that can still push for the change that's needed.
Sure. But I mean, the whole problem is, you said, you know, entire world communities are behind the desire for change. But I mean, that if you look at voting patterns across the world, that's the problem, isn't it? That's just not true.
Yes. Well, if certainly we're talking about actually speaking truth to power and getting these things done. But when we see and come together in spaces like COP, where the world leaders have equal footing in many ways, and that we can see things come together. For example, at the ICJ, where countries could actually speak their realities, we saw that it is on their side, the law. And now it's a matter of strategizing and seeing where that change can come to fruition.
Can I ask you about another, possibly it's the fourth horse of the apocalypse coming over the climate change horizon, which is artificial intelligence, because of the sheer amount of energy it requires. An OpenAI, which is the company behind ChatGPT, says it wants to add the capacity of a nuclear reactor every single week from 2030 on. What do you say to that?
Of course, we are entering a new era in this way, and so many activists and others are on top of really pushing back against these kinds of things that, you know, when we are creating movements where billionaires can move unilaterally throughout these spaces, it is going to require coming together with the people power needed to push against it. And yeah, AI will be a sort of the next frontier of where we need to see the law go to fight back.
This is a criticism that is always levelled at the COP summits, Johanna, that actually, if you're talking about trying to reduce carbon emissions, the notion that the world all flies to a particular destination in order to, you know, discuss reducing carbon emissions. I mean, eventually, doesn't technology provide us with the opportunity to not do that? I mean, in a sense, you don't want to give people the chance to be cynical about something so important, but this is a chance to be cynical.
Yeah. I mean, I still, you know, multilateralism is under attack in many ways. And it is important that people still come together. And certainly there is an era in which, you know, hypocrisies can exist. But what is the issue here is looking at what actually matters. And that's that we need decisions that come down to attacking the problem where it stands, that if we are not going to phase away from fossil fuels and actually attack the climate crisis at the heart of where it's you know, the climate crisis generates, then we aren't going to actually be solving the problem in any way. And if we don't have the countries that are actually the ones, like much of the Pacific, who are fighting against and doing things like a fossil fuel non-proliferation treaty, who are inputting ICJ language into negotiation rooms and stuff, then you're missing the opportunity to actually be able to create such change.
Yep. And those corridor conversations are very important, aren't they? And you can't,
you know,
have those. You can't have those on Zoom. Thank you very much indeed for joining us this afternoon. We appreciate your time. Johanna Guzman is a senior lawyer at the Center for International Environmental Law, and she was joining us from Brazil, where she is attending the COP30 climate summit.
Do you know, when you ask the technology giants, and I did this because I went to the Times Tech Summit, it was about a fortnight ago, what are they going to do about the huge energy expenditure for things like ChatGPT and AI? And OpenAI said to me, oh, do you know what? Well, AI will find the solutions to the energy problems. And you think, oh, right.
Oh, I think that's just such a glib answer from them, Rosie.
Of course it is.
But also, don't you think that at the moment, we aren't making the connection as consumers between using AI and the energy that AI is using? And if you were to think of it as every time you type something into ChatGPT, and I use it, I think, probably a couple of times a day now, if you think...
Do you?
I do. If you think, would I get in my car and drive somewhere a couple of times a day out of curiosity or whatever it is, I think you would have a different response to it as a product. But we see it on our phones and we think, tap, 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 bing.
Can I ask what you would have searched, without revealing sort of all your intimate details of your life, what would you have searched today?
I can't possibly tell you. I can't possibly tell you. I'll just go through.
Maybe it's what is a Labubu doll? Could have been that.
I will go through and I will try and be as honest as is humanly possible on the radio. Still got a big mortgage to pay. I will let you know what some of my ChatGPT searches have been. But sometimes I'm heavily involved in competitive Scrabble at the moment.
Oh.
And I am using ChatGPT sometimes to cheat.
Cheat!
Yeah,
there we go.
Please go to the next item.
You could have been on that pub quiz team as well, Fee. Coming up here, we're going to peer inside the Times Magazine offering tantalising glimpses of Hollywood stars and celebrity traitor revelations. It is 10 minutes to 3. This is Fee Glover and me, Rosie Wright, on Times Radio with Wix. Book your free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
Ed Vasey on Times Radio with Bupa Small Business Health Insurance. When it comes to must-listen mid-morning radio, we've got you covered. There's world-class journalism to broaden your mind, in-depth discussion that gets right to the heart of the issues, and entertaining conversation guaranteed to tickle your funny bone.
It really can be quite humorous. Get it?
Ed Vasey, tomorrow morning from 10 on Times Radio with Bupa Small Business Health Insurance. Let's get growing.
The Story, the award-winning daily news podcast from The Times. Listen in the Times Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Some people think solar only works in summer, but at Hive, we're here to show you solar works all year round, no matter the weather.
Like heavy rain, still working. Wind, yep, still working. Sleet that's basically sideways, you guessed it. Still working.
Power is getting the sun to work for you even in winter, helping you to cut your bills and lower your footprint, putting you in control of your energy. Search Hive Solar. Know your power.
Can I come down now?
Performance varies by season, weather, roof and system size.
We travel to explore, to learn, to connect. At Viking, we believe travel should be more than just a trip. It should be a doorway to cultural insight and personal enrichment. Our itineraries are designed to help you explore and engage with your destination through its food, culture, and customs. Start planning your river, ocean, or expedition journey today. Viking, exploring the world in comfort. Learn more at viking.com.
It's almost time to tiptoe down the stairs and peel open the first door on your Hotel Chocolat advent calendar. Will you reveal a dessert or a tipple reimagined in chocolate? A wreath you can nibble? Or will it be a velvet smooth drinking chocolate? Count down with all manner of imaginative advent calendars for every chocolate taste. Explore the full collection in-store and online at Hotel Chocolat.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app, and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio.
For you smiling, do you want to reveal some of your recent searches on ChatGPT?
I'm going to leave some of them out because some of them are to do with things that I've been asking on behalf of my kids. Honestly, Governor, I promise. But recently, freezing venison stew tips.
Ooh.
Claire Balding books list, Robert Redford films, UK annual gift rules, aren't I lovely, dog barking solutions and tapered allowance pension contributions.
Your dog or someone else's?
Somebody else's.
Oh, that's so annoying.
Do you just put the topic in? Because I now ask my computer really specific questions in a way that I never would have done before with, like, you know, sort of like subclauses.
Yes, yes. And please, could you help me with X, Y, Z?
Yeah, no, there's a lot of thank yous.
You're absolutely right. I've asked very specific kind of chatty questions, and ChatGPT is so bored of me doing that, it's just given me a basic headings list here.
Oh, well, it knows what you like and what you need, and then what, because it will learn from your searches.
Well, it certainly will, and sometimes, I mean, it does chat back to you in just the most astonishingly over familiar way.
It's very complimentary. What an insightful question you'll have just asked.
Yeah,
sounds like many people I've interviewed.
Let's delve inside the magazine. That is why you can hear the voice of Jamel Kerins, of course, associate editor of the Times magazine. Leo Woodall is staring out at me on the front page, looking quite charming. However, the quote here, he says, being objectified messes with your head.
Yeah. He seems like he's dealing okay with it, though.
It seems it.
I mean, I don't think we need to worry about Leo yet. But first of all, Leo Woodall is on the cover of the Times magazine. And he is looking lovely with those blue eyes. It's a lovely, lovely interview by Michael O'Dell. And if you weren't already a little bit in love with Leo Woodall, you really will be after you read this, because he just comes across as so charming and self-deprecating and quite unaffected so far by fame. Which has come quite quickly for him. And, you know, the objectification thing is interesting, because Michael asks him about it and he does say, you know, it is a bit weird, you know, sort of people saying they want to marry you who don't know you. And he says going on the tube is mostly okay. Some days it is, some days it isn't. But he does tell this anecdote in the piece about recently at the Toronto Film Festival in September, he took his parents there. And him and his mum were having lunch in a restaurant, and they were having a heart-to-heart, and she was quite upset about something, and she was crying. And a woman came over and said, I can see that you're having a really emotional conversation, and I hate to do this, but can I get a picture?
And he said yes,
which is what's so surprising. So nice about him. But he said, I mean, that's just, it's so odd that anybody would say, you're obviously really upset, but never mind.
I know, I want my selfie.
Like a selfie.
Yeah,
it's strange. Anyway, it's a lovely, lovely interview, and Leo talks about, you know, his incredible rise to fame. I mean, you know, he's gone from sort of being the cheeky guy in White Lotus, who I love, to One Day, which is huge, Bridget Jones, Mad About the Boy, Prime Target. He's now in big films. He's in Nuremberg, which has just come out, alongside Russell Crowe, and he's going to be in Tuna. It's about pianos rather than fish, I should just say. which I saw in a preview at the London Film Festival. He's excellent in it. He's just so watchable. He's alongside Dustin Hoffman. And I will say Leo totally steals the show.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Talking of stealing the show, Jo Marlowe, goodness.
Yeah. No, sorry, teacher. Sorry, I got my hand up in the studio. You've got to hear Rosie Wright's fantastic Leo Woodall adjacent anecdote from her world of show business that is intriguing.
I mean, we already know that she was a child choir member with Madonna.
Okay.
And she's going to up it. She's going to up the stakes.
This is a much more sad story. I was asked by my director friend if I could play the role of a TV news presenter in his show, Prime Target. And I said, yeah, sure, okay, I can do it, because that was my old job. Fine. First of all, it was a challenge because I was only given 10 words to conduct this interview, because if I'd had 11, I would have got royalties.
Did you know that?
It's very
extraordinary.
But I didn't get to interview Leo. It was his professor, his maths professor in Prime Target, David Morrissey. And so my first question was, your book? Which is quite hard to deliver in a question. Question two was,
I think you did that very well.
Fascinating. Which is not a question. Anyway, I did this. I was very excited. I then saw, late 6 months down the line, Prime Target is on Apple TV with Leo Woodall. Watched the first episode. And David Morrissey, who I'd interviewed, was killed off at the end of episode one. So I thought my charming interview with him of all of my 10 words hit the cutting room floor.
Oh, Rosie.
So it was my chance to perform alongside Leo. It never made it to the big screen. I thought maybe there'll be a flashback. And
maybe
there'll
be a season two.
Very unlikely. So I never had my moment with Leo. It's very sad. So you've spent more time with him in this photo shoot.
I have.
I'm very envious. There we go.
In multiple rooms in a hotel, in multiple outfits. Him, not me.
Talking of outfits, Joe Marler was very cross, it seemed. And he's very honest that he had to spend some of his £30,000 fee for appearing on Celebrity Traitors to buy clothes to wear on the show.
To buy long trousers, which he objects to. Yeah, he doesn't like covering his shins. I have to say, I'm probably the one... I'm sort of ashamed to admit this, but I am the person in the country who didn't watch The Traitors or Celebrity Traitors and have never watched an episode.
Yes.
And I also don't think I'm missing anything, guys. Sorry, take it up with me at another time. But
and the other 11 million people who will watch it.
Life's too short and I lack commitment in those sort of TV shows. Anyway, I'm very taken with Joe Marler just from what I know of him from this interview. And I sort of think I'd watch Joe Marler do things. Anyway, if you also didn't watch Traitors and you don't follow rugby, he's a 35-year-old former England rugby player who is a sort of breakout star. He's massive, even more massive from being on Celebrity Traitors because he managed to put on a stone and a half in 3 weeks in the castle.
There was so much food and he said the weights they provided in the gym weren't heavy enough. So he just didn't do the exercise.
Well, according to his wife, it was because... every scene he was eating.
Of course, she noticed that as well.
He had a great time. He earned 30 grand, had to spend some of it on long trousers because apparently they wouldn't let him wear shorts in the funeral scene. It's such a charming interview that Robert Crampton has done and he comes across absolutely brilliantly. You know, and it's this really interesting mix of very tough on the field, but quite vulnerable. He talks about mental health. He's very involved with... the campaign against living miserably. He talks openly about therapy and taking antidepressants. He also talks about life after rugby and kind of struggling to find an identity, which he's not sure if he's pulling off yet or just really ballsing up.
And he talks honestly about his finances as well. He sort of said his rugby savings were dwindling, so he was thinking about what the next project is. And I thought, gosh, he really has been sort of prepared to tell you everything.
Yeah, really open. He's doing a podcast, obviously.
Yeah, but I think he'll be able to do an awful lot right now because for those who did watch The Celebrity Traitors, he was really, really the standout star. Jane, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Jane Mulcairns, of course, you can read all of that inside the magazine that will be part of your Times bundle this Saturday.
He was mesmerising, wasn't he? When Joe Marler was in the room, whatever room he was in, you just had your eyes on him. And that's quite rare, especially in a lineup that included so many other massive, massive egos.
He said at the beginning some of the other celebrities just thought he was sort of like a prop hand carrying around the kit because they didn't know who he was because he was one of the relative unknowns. Well, not anymore.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
All of that takes us to 3 o'clock. You're listening to Fee Glover and Rosie Wright on Times Radio. In the next hour of our programme, the US government shutdown is over. But could revelations about Donald Trump and Jeffrey Epstein bring the president back down to earth? Our economic growth over here continues to be essentially nothing. Bad news for Rachel Reeves, ahead of the budget. We're going to talk to an economist and ask what she can do to turn things around. And our big interview after 3:30 is with the nonagenarian actress and singer Petula Clark. Stuart Willey has the latest headlines.
Fee, thank you. Good afternoon. A report into the death of Sara Sharif, murdered by her father and stepmother in Surrey, has found racial sensitivity was one reason her abuse wasn't uncovered. The independent review concluded she was failed by the safeguarding system, finding numerous missed opportunities to save her. The 10-year-old girl was found dead in 2023 when her father called police after fleeing to Pakistan. Baroness Spellman, Amanda Spellman, is a former Chief Inspector of Education. She told Times Radio, authorities need a stronger focus on the interests of children.
There's an optimism in public policy that families are fixable. And yet, with families like this, where both the father and the stepmother have such long histories, the father in particular of domestic abuse, I do worry that the current direction of policy is back towards the optimistic, we can fix every family.
Wes Streeting has hit out at rumours he was trying to oust the Prime Minister, describing it as a silly Westminster soap opera. It comes as Sir Keir Starmer says he's been assured anonymous briefings of a leadership coup didn't come from Number 10. The Prime Minister insists he will absolutely deal with anybody responsible. Reporters have been asking the Health Secretary about the turmoil.
I'm sure that Morgan McSweeney, Keir Starmer and everyone else is absolutely delighted with the news today that NHS waiting lists
are
falling.
Do you have confidence in Morgan McSweeney?
One of the great things about being here in the Northwest today is I can leave all the trivial Westminster bubble stuff behind and instead focus on what we are doing, which is the change the public voted for.
A police officer who drove his motorcycle into an 81-year-old woman has been found not guilty of causing death by dangerous driving. Metropolitan Police motorcyclist Christopher Harrison was escorting the Duchess of Edinburgh through London when the fatal crash happened in 2023. Police and crime commissioners in England and Wales are to be scrapped. The elected officials were introduced in 2012 to oversee police forces and have responsibility for setting budgets. But the government says at least £100 million will be saved when council leaders and mayors take over their roles. Policing Minister Sarah Jones says the project hasn't worked.
The model has failed to live up to expectations. Public understanding of and engagement with our police and crime commissioners remains low, despite efforts to raise their profile. Less than a quarter of voters turned out to vote for them in the 2024 elections, and two in five people are unaware PCCs even exist.
Ed Miliband says he won't apologise for picking a British company to build the UK's first small modular nuclear reactor. Rolls-Royce has been chosen for the project in North Wales. The US ambassador says he's extremely disappointed. There are warnings flooding could hit parts of the UK tomorrow as the Met Office issues an amber warning for rain. Storm Claudia will bring heavy downpours and strong winds for much of the country. And for a news bulletin when you want it, search for the Times News Briefing on the Times Radio app.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. Weekday afternoons on Times Radio with Wickes Kitchens and Bathrooms.
It's 4 minutes past three. You're in the company for the next hour with Fee Glover and me, Rosie Wright, sitting in for Jane Garvey. John Pienaar will be here in an hour's time. Now, Donald Trump has signed a bill which has ended the longest government shutdown in US history. But a day the president was trying to claim triumph for his party saw him dragged further into the Jeffrey Epstein scandal. Congress released thousands of pages of documents from the estate of the convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein, including some that mentioned Trump. We got three emails initially yesterday and then many more. Now, lawmakers, including Republican ones, could force the release of even more documents. David K. Johnson is a Pulitzer Prize winning investigative journalist. He is also the author of It's Even Worse Than You Think, What the Trump Administration is Doing to America. Well, David is with us now. David, good afternoon.
Hello. Good to be with you, Rosalie.
We'll come on to the emails in just a moment. But first of all, can we just start with this government shutdown? It's such an alien concept to us here in the UK because we don't sort of have a system or a strategy where something like that could happen. 43 days the government was effectively not operating. What finally led to the end of it?
Well, once the Trump administration decided they were going to punish those people who travel by airplane a lot, which means people who have money or expense accounts, the politics began to shift because this was no longer about Trump's wanting to deny health care to 17 million Americans by taking away a tax credit that made it possible for them to afford health insurance and then to take food away. And he literally went to court to fight to not provide food to poor pregnant women, toddlers, infants, and poor adults, almost 50 million of the 340 million Americans. The politics shifted. It didn't shift because of the poor. It shifted because of how it affected people who travel all the time in airplanes. But this hasn't gone away. The deal only lasts until the end of January. Then there'll be another funding crisis. And the Democrats have made it clear they will not go along with stripping health care away from the poorest people in America.
And just to explain, the airports is because air traffic controllers weren't being paid, were they, while the government shutdown was happening. So lots of them were calling in sick and saying they weren't turning up at work. And therefore, we then had the flight disruption. So
And Rosalie, to be clear, the Trump administration could have used military air controllers to fill in for the unpaid controllers who didn't show up. This was a choice to make air traffic slow down and disrupt and cause people in some cases to have two, three, four flights in a row canceled. They chose to do this because they understood the political leverage it provided.
So what happens? We have this sort of very intense period of negotiation and almost sort of this grand game of chicken, really, on which side would move first or who would be persuaded to the other side. The deal that's been put in place, which means we now have a resumption of the government services, there's only temporary until January. Has actually anything shifted or might we end up in the same situation then?
Well, the pain being felt by some Republican lawmakers, especially after the elections 8 days ago, in which the Democrats romped across the country, they romped, have certainly going to cause some Republicans in vulnerable districts to rethink, you know, do you really want to have a war on the poor? And that will be a big theme of the Democrats, that the Republican Party and Donald Trump are engaged in a war against poor people, particularly on health care. And remember, unlike every other modern country, including yours, we don't have universal health care. Health care is not a right in the United States, because in America, civil rights are grow out of property rights, whereas in Europe and the UK, they grow out of the concept of human dignity. And you get very different legal issues as a result.
I'm sure the Republicans would not describe it as a war against poor people, but I understand the position from which you are coming from. And obviously, they are not here. Let's move on to the developments yesterday. That's our sort of, let's not get too into the weeds of it, but it is in some part linked to the fact that the government shutdown was ended. Yesterday, we got sort of two dispatches of documents. We got these three emails, and then we got 20,000 more documents. In essence, what have we learned there about Donald Trump's implication into Jeffrey Epstein's activities?
Well, we know from these beyond refutation that Donald Trump was deeply involved with Jeffrey Epstein, despite all the efforts to say I hardly knew who he was. We know that.
Can you define deeply involved? Sort of give us some examples of what the email showed.
Epstein has referred to Trump as his best friend for 10 years. The documents, and I have not been through all of them, you can't in this period of time, but the documents show that there was a continuing frequent engagement in New York City and Mar-a-Lago between Trump and Epstein. In Palm Beach, where Mar-a-Lago is. Epstein owned a mansion not far from Trump's Mar-a-Lago mansion. And so there's really no question that the two of them were deeply involved. I think the most interesting thing that came out yesterday was that Epstein in 2016 sent an email to a New York Times reporter based in London offering to give him pictures of underage girls in bikinis with Donald Trump. Now, any good reporter would have said, oh, well, let's go see those, and then said, well, you know, those aren't really news. There's nothing wrong with being in a picture with a teenage girl. You think there's something more here I should see? And ask for compromising photos. And that's, of course, the issue is there irrefutable proof of Donald Trump in inappropriate situations with underage girls?
Yeah, and I haven't seen the details of that specific email that you mentioned. One that has caused a bit of a stir, and what is very difficult, we must say, with all of these emails, is we do not have the context around them as to why they were sent. So there is no sort of smoking gun that I think the Democrats are hoping to have unearthed or found. But I think what it does do is raises questions over whether Donald Trump has been fully transparent about what he knew about Jeffrey Epstein. That, as much, I think, is true.
Yeah, Rosalie, I don't think there's any question at all that Donald has been less than transparent. When he ran in the 2024 election, he kept saying, we're going to make all the Epstein files secret. Then as soon as he got in office and they had FBI agents go through the records that the Justice Department had, suddenly, well, we don't need to release these. There's nothing here. There's nothing to see. Why would you do that unless there's something compromising is the reasonable response to that. These files, one way or another, are going to come out. There are, at the moment, by one vote, enough members of the House for what's called a discharge petition to get those files released. And the Trump administration, of course, has complete legal authority right now. And people should know I teach law, has complete legal authority to release all the files. It's chosen not to do so. Now, there's going to be tremendous pressure brought to bear on the four Republicans, Marjorie Taylor Greene, Lauren Boebert, Nancy Mace, and the congressman from Kentucky, Massey, to change their vote so that this measure will fail. So next week, we'll see if the measure actually passes.
So but one way or another, I'm so sorry to interrupt. Can we go back a step just to explain the logistics of what's happened? We've had this one set of tranche of documents. There could be another, but that hinges on a vote. So therefore, you're saying the pressure will be on those Republicans to try and stop that happening.
That's right. There are four Republicans who said we'll vote to make all of these files public, and tremendous pressure is going to be brought on them to back off. In fact, Lauren Boebert, the Colorado congresswoman, was taken to the Situation Room in the basement of the White House in an effort to pressure her. And after she left, she mocked Trump. So it doesn't seem that she's going to give in. But the pressure to release these files is going to grow. And there's every reason to think that the lawyers handling the Epstein estate have a lot of records that might be very damaging to Donald. So this issue is not going to go away. I can tell you what you should expect if and when compromising photos or video appear of Donald Trump.
I mean, that is an if and a when, but go ahead.
Absolutely an if. Caroline Leavitt will say, fake photos, AI. Not to be believed. These are hoaxes, because that's what she's been saying all the way along. And what other defense could you offer? And by the way, we have forensic tools to establish if a photo or a video has been altered. So that defense won't work with people who understand the technology.
How do you imagine the White House is going to try and get out ahead of this? Because they have been trying to do that sort of unsuccessfully for the last year, which is why we have had this sort of drip, drip, drip of the information.
Well, the nicest thing would be a time machine so Donald could go back in the campaign and not say, we're going to release all the Epstein files as soon as I'm president. Mm. That would be the nicest thing to do. I don't know how they're going to get ahead of this. I don't see a path through them. But they will. What they'll try to do instead is discredit the information. Don't trust your lying eyes. Don't believe what's there. This is all a hoax. They keep calling this whole thing a hoax. The big question will be if there's irrefutable proof of serious conduct, which would be criminal but no longer prosecutable in the United States by Donald Trump, will that arouse moral indignation in America or not? I think it will, and I don't think he can survive that as someone who's known Trump for 40 years and written about him in 3.5 books. But there are a lot of people who think the opposite. They think the American public is so embracing that, you know, Donald is who he is, that they'll go, yeah, all right, so he did these horrible things with underage girls. I don't care. He's not doing them today.
Alleged to have done.
Absolutely.
David, why the Democrats had the opportunity before Donald Trump was president again to shine much greater light on this, and they didn't take that opportunity. Why not?
Well, Joe Biden, when he became president, appointed an attorney general, a very highly respected judge, and said, I'm not going to touch the Justice Department. Presidents should not. The Justice Department is here to represent the people, not my office. And Merrick Garland, the attorney general, is a Boy Scout. He waited a long time to begin to really investigate Trump over the insurrection on January 6th, over the documents, hundreds of thousands of pages of documents that were taken to Mar-a-Lago. And this effort to "we're above partisan politics" didn't work. There were a few Democrats in the House and the Senate who wanted to be aggressive. The party did not about this. It's unfortunate that we didn't have a proper and full investigation, and it's to the shame of the Democrats who we're above the fray. We're better than the Trump Republicans, and that didn't work out for them at all.
David, thank you for your time and for the context. David K. Johnston, who is the author of It's Even Worse Than You Think, What the Trump Administration is Doing to America. I mean, the wider context of this is Donald Trump's approval ratings are actually really starting to decline, and he cannot get away from this crisis that gets bigger and bigger, and therefore the questions loom. And people are coming to us making their own assumptions.
Yeah. It's interesting, isn't it, though, that the approval ratings drop is being put down to his inability to have come good on his economic promises.
Not this scandal.
Not this. It doesn't seem as yet to have really dented his popularity in a way that maybe we would think that it should. Interestingly, there are two very similarly themed texts that we've received in the last couple of minutes as your guest was on air, Rosie. I'm just going to read one of them, but Mike was making the same point. Utter tosh from your American guest. As a former air traffic controller, I can vouch for the fact that you can't just put military air traffic controllers into the roles vacated, because it takes about 3 months to a year to qualify on a new ATC position. Now, GDP in this country is up by, wait for it, everybody, 0.1%. don't blow up the party balloons just yet. We're going to talk about what might change that and when in a couple of moments' time, 16 minutes past three. You're listening to Fee Glover and Rosie Wright on Times Radio with Wix, the experts in kitchens and bathrooms.
Oh, we can all be a bit forgetful from time to time, and Mom was no exception. Always losing her glasses and then not being able to find them again. It's a good job they were two for one at the opticians.
At the last count, I think she had 12 pairs.
Yeah, but there came a point when we noticed that it was more than just being a bit forgetful. And that's when we knew that Mum was going to need someone to give her some extra help around the house.
So that's where we got Claire in to help. She's Mum's care professional from Home Instead. She's wonderful and comes to the house most days. Home Instead are amazing. It really is the best quality care in your own home. And it's really reassuring to know that Mum's being looked after by someone as patient and kind as Claire.
Yeah, and as well as all the day-to-day stuff that Claire does, she also helps Mum with her favourite thing in the world, baking. Mm. Mum's chocolate cake was always the talk of the town, and it turns out that with Claire's help,
it still is. For award-winning home care you can trust, go to homeinstead.co.uk.
I believe those who are curious see the world differently. At Viking, we have always been curious and quite a bit different. For over 25 years, we have been connecting the thinking person with the world. First on the great rivers, then on all five oceans, now on all seven continents. We are One Viking, exploring the world in comfort.
Visit Times Radio on YouTube for the latest videos and interviews.
Weekday afternoons on Times Radio with Wix. Are you dreaming of a new kitchen? Let Wix guide you through the wide range of stunning styles, appliances and worktops. Kitchens start from under £3,000. Get started by booking your free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
Now, it's been an absolute treat to host with Rosie Wright this week on the afternoon show. We've had a kind of give and take, a tear and share of experience and information, haven't we? Because you're quite a bit younger than me, Rosie. I think coming in your early 30s, I'm coming in my late 50s. And so you've introduced me to, what were the dangly things that everybody's got?
Oh no, I'm not proud of this. A Labubu doll.
Okay.
Only because I know what it is, but I am not an owner of one. And would, I think even if was gifted one, would then re-gift.
Okay, but at least you know about them. So
yes.
That is completely outside of my jurisdiction. But I've introduced you to Petula Clark.
With pleasure.
Because I don't think that it is exposing any ignorance, and nor should we ever be ashamed of any ignorance anyway. You weren't really aware of her oeuvre, were you?
No, I think it's very unfair she ends up in the same category as the Labubu doll craze.
Yes, I think I'm with you on that. After a long and glorious career as one of the most successful female singers of all time, with 100 million records sold, you're right. Not being part of the same kind of horizon as some dangly things that you can get cheap fakes of probably on Temu is not where Petula would have wanted to end up. A fantastic interview is going to come your way about her long and glorious career. Jane did this with Petula last week before Jane headed up to Crosby for the week. So that is going to come your way after 3:30. And if, like me, you thought, well, I know Downtown, but I'm not sure that I know any of her other hits. Well, you probably do, actually. And some of the things that are worth knowing about her, too. She married a Frenchman, so went over to live in France. And while she was there, she became that country's most popular female vocalist. So she really is a treat. And that's coming your way after 3:30. We always put the big interview of the day into the podcast, which confusingly this week has been with me and Jane, because we've managed to do that remotely where she's staying in a safe house. So that drops every evening at 6 o'clock. This week we've been talking about hula hooping, the extraordinary rate at which guinea pigs breed, driving with parrots, and the highs and lows of Airbnb hosting. All pretty average fare for us. Your 3:30 interviews in full recently include David Olashoga, Joanna Lumley and Rick Astley. And recently, Jane also spoke to, it's kind of part of a series she's doing with 92 and 93-year-olds, Lady Glenconner, former lady-in-waiting to Princess Margaret. And she told Jane that Queen Elizabeth probably did spoil her son, Andrew.
it was this thing after the war that we wanted to spoil our children, I think.
Yes.
And I think that's probably what she did.
So you didn't, I mean, you and your circle who spent time with the royal family, were there mutterings about the way Andrew conducted himself?
Well, not really. I mean, I didn't see him very much. He was quite forceful. I mean, I remember him snatching toys away from my son, a bit like that, you know.
Even as a baby?
Yeah, he was a handful. I think that's what his nanny called him, a handful.
Well, that's a euphemism for our times, isn't it? The UK economy grew an unexpectedly small amount in the latest quarter at just 0.1%. It is lower than the last quarter, while real GDP per person didn't increase at all. Stephen Millard is the Deputy Director for Macroeconomics at the National Institute of Economic and Social Research, or NIESR. Stephen Millard, very good afternoon from me. How concerning is this to you?
Good afternoon. Well, it's GDP growth certainly came in weaker than we were expecting in the third quarter. But even despite that, we think the GDP growth over the year as a whole is going to be at 1.4%, which is actually pretty good. It's not what you would call excitingly wonderful, but it's pretty good. We think that the slow momentum, though, as illustrated by growth in the third quarter, that's going to continue. And a lot of that is down to the uncertainty around what's going to happen at the budget later this month.
Why, if it's pretty good, Stephen, do we seem to be still feeling so bad?
That's a very good question. I think a lot of it is to do with the perception that prices are a lot higher now than they were in the past. And although wages have caught up, I don't know that people necessarily have sort of realised that in a way. I think the other thing is, of course, that big inflation hit very badly the poorer households who spend a larger proportion of their income, and particularly on food and energy, which is where prices went up a lot. So I think the perception that times are not good, that's really been driven by the high inflation that we had, particularly in 2023, but that's kind of still there now to a degree.
And when I said in our introduction that real GDP per person hasn't increased at all, what did I mean by that?
Well, this the way of thinking about that is the total income that the economy has divided by the number of people. So it's, if you like, the extra income that each person in the economy gets over the course of a year. Now, the not increasing at all was just in the one quarter. So that's the 3 months to September versus the 3 months to May. Over the year as a whole, GDP per person has increased by 0.8%, almost 1%. But again, relative to, say, what we used to see in the 1990s and 2000s, It's not a marked improvement in people's standards of living.
Is that a figure that is dragged down by the huge benefits weight?
No, I don't think that. I don't think that's the case. And benefits is part of the income that's going to people. So it's part of that thing that's being divided, as I say, by the number of people out there in the economy. We would be doing better as an economy if more people were in employment. That is clearly the case, and policies aimed at getting people back into employment are going to help. And it's certainly that sort of active labour market policy, if you like, that's much more important, I think, than a consideration of whether benefits are a little bit too high or a little bit too low.
And if income tax is going up as predicted in the budget, what immediate effect does that have on GDP?
Well, it will have an effect on GDP as it will make there'll be less income, if you like, to go around. People will probably cut back on their consumption because obviously they have to pay a little bit more of their income out in taxes. We calculate, though, that the impact on GDP, at least in the first year, will not be that large. It will get a little bit larger into the second year. But if the tax increase were to come through income tax itself, then actually the impact on GDP would be much smaller than if the increase in taxes were to come via other sources, such as, for example, VAT or corporation tax.
Right. And Rachel Reeves is very keen to tell us about global headwinds and the fact that that is affecting everything that she is trying to do and the Labour government is trying to do at the moment, and that we, every person in work, is trying to do at the moment. So is the only way to really verify that statement to compare us to other countries? And if we do that, what do we learn?
I mean, there are global headwinds at the moment coming through, in particular the uncertainty caused by Donald Trump's tariff announcements. I think that's certainly the case. I think the UK has been affected by the fact that it has become more expensive. It is more expensive now to trade with continental Europe, our biggest and nearest trading partner, than it was prior to Brexit. But to be honest with you, I think a lot of the problems, a lot of the slowdown in the UK economy at the moment has been the result of the uncertainty around actually what's going to happen in the budget. Which could have been avoided, we think, if the Chancellor had left herself a much bigger buffer against her fiscal rules than the £10 billion that, in fact, she left herself. So we'd like to see a bigger buffer coming up in this budget to reduce uncertainty so that people can actually move forward, invest more, spend more, and the economy continue to grow.
Sure. And while we have you, Stephen, there is a lot of speculation that Keir Starmer might not be in his position forever. I think John Pienaar said he could hear the fizzle of all of the fuses being lit to replace him. Downing Street have claimed that getting rid of him and Rachel Reeves would cause turmoil in the markets. How credible is that? And doesn't it depend on who might then take over and what flavour that takeover would have?
It would clearly depend on who would take over and what flavour that takeover might have. I think they do have a point, though, in that, in particular, if the Chancellor does sort of restore that fiscal space in her budget via increases in taxes, that will reassure markets. I think markets would be very worried if then there were a new chancellor coming in, particularly one, shall we say, more to the left of the party than the current chancellor. So I think they do have a point in saying that should Keir Starmer and Rachel Reeves be replaced, I think there would be an adverse market reaction.
And how frustrating has it been to you for the budget to be so late and for there to have been so much time for us to speculate about what might be in the budget? Or has it actually been a very clever ploy because there's been so much speculation and therefore one would hope some kind of discussion on what that speculation has thrown up?
There has, to be fair, been a lot of kite flying we've seen ahead of the budget. We are not big fans of that. I think, you know, the idea is that the Chancellor is supposed to present the budget to Parliament, and it's Parliament that are supposed to debate and assess the policies that are announced in it. It's actually been very good for us here at NISA, because obviously all the while there's speculation, we're managing to stay in the news and doing interviews like this. So kind of good for us, but it's not clear that it's good for the country as a whole, because of course all the uncertainty that's been created, that's going to affect investment, it's going to affect consumption. People like certainty. They like to know what's happening. And the fact we've had to wait for longer than would have been ideal has not been good for the economy as a whole.
Right. Well, do you know what? I think it's rather delightful and honest of you to admit that it's been extremely good for you, Stephen. Thank you very much indeed for talking to us this afternoon. Stephen Millard is the Deputy Director for Macroeconomics at NISA.
And so much of the kite flying has flown right through the copy of the Times that you might pick up or read on your app every morning. And I appreciate it is hugely frustrating, but we get these rumours leaked to us by our fantastic political team, Stephen Swinford, Ollie Wright, all the voices that you know, for us to interrogate them. And it is all part, ultimately, of the government strategy to sort of feel the waters and manage all of our expectations, which is why pretty much all of us have sort of conceded to the fact to say income tax is going to go up.
There is no place we'd rather be, as the Rosie. It has just gone 3:30. Our big interview is with the actress and singer Petula Clark after the latest news headlines with Stuart Willie.
across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio.
Fee, thank you. Good afternoon. 10-year-old Sarah Sharif was failed in multiple ways by the safeguarding system and should never have been placed in the care of her father and stepmother. The damning review also found racial sensitivity was one reason her abuse wasn't uncovered. She was found dead at the family home in Surrey in August 2023. The Times' deputy chief reporter is Ben Ellery.
Really is shocking, and the report has made 15 recommendations, one of which is that they need to have experts who can advise them on cultural issues. But it has left a lot of people asking, you know, does it really need to be set out as a recommendation? Surely this is, you know, common sense.
A Metropolitan Police motorcyclist has been found not guilty of causing death by careless driving after hitting a pensioner while escorting the Duchess of Edinburgh. Christopher Harrison struck 81-year-old Helen Holland while travelling through West London in 2023. Wes Streeting is looking to move on from the backlash to anonymous briefings which suggested he was trying to oust the Prime Minister. The Health Secretary has likened the rumours to a silly Westminster soap opera, while Sir Keir Starmer says he's been assured they didn't come from Number 10. And police and crime commissioners in England and Wales are being scrapped. Ministers say the savings will be invested into more neighbourhood policing instead. Don't forget, you can set the Times News Briefing as your news service on Alexa.
This is Times Radio.
When you think of a hero, you don't necessarily picture a crumpet. But when Warburtons needed a hero to run marathons and raise money for Cancer Research UK, there was only one person to call. Crumpy, a 6'4" anthropomorphic crumpet, a.k.a. Lee from Sales in a crumpet suit. Did Crumpy help raise £3 million for Cancer Research UK? Oh, yes. Is Crumpy machine washable? We can only pray. Good stuff. It's baked in at Warburtons. Follow Crumpy's journey. Search Warburtons Good Stuff.
When they say, don't get me anything, you know what they really mean. Give the birthday gift they really want from Hotel Chocolat. Cakes transformed into chocolate for those who choose dessert over a starter. Or, if they like it nutty, a box bursting with pralines and epically crunchy whole nut chocolates. Add a gift bag and a complimentary gift sleeve and make it a birthday moment. Find the gift you know they'll love in store or online at Hotel Chocolat.
Here's to the moment, to the places that give you perspective and the people who change that perspective, the curiosity that leads you to the edge of the earth and the joy that meets you there. Silver Sea brings you closer to the rare, the remote and the remarkable. On spacious yet intimate ships that show you what most miss. Here's to having every reason to celebrate. To finding more. Learn more at silversea.com.
Weekday afternoons on Times Radio with Wix, the experts in kitchens. Choose Wix for your new kitchen and then sit back and relax, knowing it's filled with products that are reassuringly backed up with guarantees. Book your free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
You may know our next guest from this.
When you're alone and life is making you lonely, you can always go downtown. When you've got worries, all the noise and the hurry seems to help, I know. Downtown, just listen.
Petula Clark is 93 years old this week. She is a CBE and she's just written a memoir called Is That You, Petula? She's been famous for most of her life. She was a film star back in the 50s before conquering the pop charts with songs like Don't Sleep in the Subway, I Couldn't Live Without You, and that all-time stone-cold classic Downtown. She's also no stranger to the stage, appearing in Sunset Boulevard, Mary Poppins and Blood Brothers. She married Claude Wolfe in 1961, a Frenchman, and the French took her into their hearts when she moved there with her husband. In the 1950s, she was the most popular female singer in the country. But it all began for Petula as a child star performing to soldiers during World War II. Jane spoke to her last week, and that's where they started.
You know, all us kids during the war were leading rather peculiar lives. You know, it was air raids and air raid shelters and all that stuff and not much food. And I was singing for the troops. My dad was in the army and he used to take me around to the different camps, you know. I would, and there was another little girl who was doing the same thing, Julie Andrews, and we used to sleep in the luggage racks We were both very skinny, and I've spoken to her about it a few times, and she remembers it with great affection. It was a very special time in our lives.
You weren't frightened?
No, not at all, you know. No, not at all. I don't think kids were specially frightened. We were lucky, of course. We weren't actually hit by a bomb, but it was all around us, and it just seemed normal to us. That's the way it was.
Now, I knew that Vera Lynn was the Force's sweetheart.
Yes.
You, and as you say, Julie Andrews, were child stars who were sort of adopted by the troops. Is that right?
Yes, we sort of represented the kids who had been left behind. You know, the first show that I did for the BBC was at the Criterion Theatre, which is still there, of course. Yeah. And it's a beautiful old theatre.
Piccadilly Circus.
Right in the middle.
Yeah.
And it's still there. And the BBC used to use it a lot because it's underground. And it was really a glorified air raid shelter, full of sandbags. In fact, I went there not that long ago to see a play. And as I walked down these stairs, which I remember well, I could smell the sandbags.
Could you?
You know? And I went there as a child with some other children to send a message to my uncle who was serving in the forces. And during the rehearsal for it, there was a huge air raid. The place was shaking. And the producer said, well, would somebody like to come up and sing a song, say a piece of poetry, calm things down? And nobody else volunteered, so I put my hand up and said, I'll sing a song. And I did. I sang it into the big old BBC microphone.
Yeah. What did you sing?
I sang Mighty Like a Rose. You're not going to ask me to sing it, I hope.
Well, it was, obviously. But
no, but it was sort of, sweetest little fella everybody knows. Don't know what to call him, but he's mighty like a rose. I sang it a bit higher in those days.
And you were tiny, absolutely tiny.
Well, I still am.
Yes, well, but I'm no giant myself, so I'm not going to cast aspersions.
Yes, I was very young.
Yes, and I suppose because you, as you've said, you were so young, you were too young to be genuinely fearful. And I suppose you didn't really question the peculiarity of your existence either.
Not at all. No, that's just the way it was. And for a lot of kids, that's the way it was. Mine was a bit special, I suppose, because I was singing for the troops and singing on the BBC, which was really a big deal in those days. You know, there was no television. And the BBC more or less took me under their wing. And I did a lot of other things on radio. And then eventually I had my own television show, Pet's Parlour.
Great name.
Kind of awful, isn't it? Well, but it was a cosy little show, you know, with a piano player, Joe Henderson, and myself. And it was popular, I suppose.
Well, it was. Don't do yourself down. It really was. I'm very interested in the fact that you had a contract with Rank, the film company, didn't you?
That was a bit later, yes.
A bit later. But they were very keen to keep you as a child. And I was really struck by the detail in the book about the ankle socks you had to wear. And they would bound your breasts as well.
Indeed, they did.
I mean, that wouldn't be allowed
that
today.
That really was a difficult moment.
Yeah.
I was under contract to Rank as an actress, not as a singer.
Right.
We weren't making musicals anyway. So
that
was a new experience for me, being an actress in front of a camera and working with other people, and I enjoyed it. Very different to singing for an audience.
Mm.
Yes, I was much more valuable to them as a child, and as you say, ankle socks and bound in bosom, and it was difficult. You know, when you're getting a bit of a bosom, you don't want it to be bound in.
No.
You want people to see it.
Yes, ideally, yes.
But, you know, adolescence almost didn't exist in those days. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Very different. And you had a strange existence in the sense that your mother stayed at home. She'd been very ill. She was very ill. And you travelled with your father and the woman you now know to have been his partner. And I think it's important, you didn't dislike this lady,
not
did you?
Not at all. She was a great lady.
Yeah, but it was all a little strange. You now realise how strange it was, I guess.
Of course.
Yeah.
Of course, there again, you know, I adored my father. And for me, he could do no wrong. And this lady, Annie, I adored too. And we used to travel around doing my shows. And my sister, Babs, stayed at home with our mum. And the family was cut in two, really. And it was not a very nice situation. It was, and of course, as I got older, I started to realise that it was not a good thing to do. But there again, that's life.
You are, well, I don't want to put words into your mouth. You're ambivalent about your father. Would that be right? You loved him, but
yes, I mean, as I got older, I realised that this was not a good situation. He was my manager, except, of course, he knew very little about show business. But then show business in those days was not like today. But my father had always wanted to be an actor himself. He was a very handsome man and quite charismatic. But as I got older, I realised that at times, you know, when we'd be at home having a meal together, I wasn't sure if I was talking to my dad or my manager. And it was difficult. And eventually, and let's face it, I was in my early 20s, I was ready to break away from all this. And I did. And it wasn't easy. I wanted to make my own mistakes, and I certainly did. but it wasn't easy for him either.
How did he take your continued success? Because you then started making some fabulous hit songs, hits in America, hits here. How was he about all that?
Well, that was quite a bit later. The big thing was that I went to France. I went to France to do a show at the Olympia Theatre, which I didn't realise, but it was like the Palladium. Mm. And it was a very important show for Europe Number One, which was the big radio station. I think it still is, actually. And I did it. I sang very badly because I had really awful cold. And they absolutely pulled the place down. They loved it, much to my surprise. And this started a whole... And that's where I met my husband.
Claude.
You know, Claude. And Claude sort of took over my career. It just happened that way. And, of course, when my dad met Claude, he was okay with it because he realised that this was a good man and he was going to take care of me. So that was all right.
That I think, was why I thought you were half French, because so much of your success, and it's unusual for a British singer to be taken and approved of by the French, and indeed throughout Europe. You were big in Belgium, big in Switzerland, where you now live. They adopted you, didn't they?
Yes, and I recorded in Italian and German too. Yeah. I did a lot.
That's very rare.
I suppose so. But there again, I was just being swept along by, what do you call, destiny. That's, you know, there was no plan to this. You know, some people say to me, oh, well, yes, you know, there's some kind of Svengali behind all this. Not at all. No. It just happened.
Tell us about Claude, because obviously he looms large in your life and in your memoir. So what was he like?
Oh, well, I lost him not that long ago, so it's hard for me to talk about it, but he was gorgeous. He was very handsome. He worked at the record company who were releasing my records, Vogue Records, and he was their public relations guy. He was very good at it. And really the reason why I made my first French record, because I wanted to get back to Paris to see this bloke again. You know? Right.
And, so as good a reason as any.
He was driving me like a maniac all over Paris and taking me to places like this, you know, meeting the different interviewers and disc jockeys and doing television. I couldn't speak a word of French. That's another point.
At the time, you couldn't.
At the time, yeah. No.
So
not
how
at all.
How did you learn songs then?
Just I did it phonetically.
Did you?
You know?
Right.
And little by little, because I wanted to, I started learning French and the French way of life. It's those days, Paris was like the most foreign place you can imagine. You know, nobody spoke English and they were a bit rude. And, you know, all the women seemed to be very sexy and the blokes wanted to sort of pop into bed with you, all that kind of. You know, it was a bit of a cliche, the whole thing. And I was very English. And so it was a strange meeting, this whole thing. But I was in love with Claude. he was in love with me, and we had to decide who was going to live where. Now, he spoke very bad English, and he spoke a lot of, you know, English or American jazz.
Yes.
You know, with a lot of nasty words in there, okay. You know. And I spoke virtually no French. So we just, I don't know, we limped our way through this romance until we decided somebody had to move, and it decided it was going to be me. Because I had the beginnings of this career in France, which I had not been ready for at all, but they liked me.
Now, I can imagine that singing in French is... Well, I'd love you to sing for us in French, if you don't mind. But what's it like to sing in German? Because that's not the most...
That was always a problem.
Right.
German was always a problem. Yeah. I always had somebody there to, you know, to coach me. And I would do several takes of a song. And eventually, say, ah, wunderbar, yeah. I said, wunderbar. It sounds awful to me. But I had a lot of hits in German.
Yes. Oh, I believe so. French, it is easier to understand for us. And I find it personally myself very soothing to hear a song sung in French. What was your favourite French song to sing?
Well, I was very lucky. I got to meet Serge Gainsbourg, who wrote songs for me. There's a wonderful lyric writer called Pierre Delannoy, who wrote specially for me. And he used my accent a lot for it, you know. They were special songs. And then, of course, I had Marin, which was Sailor, which was a hit first in English, became a hit in French, and another one called Romeo, which was also a hit in French. And a lot of them were English songs with French lyrics, but I was having a lot of songs written for me, as I say, by Serge.
Yes.
And he would come over because we were recording in London. At that time, London was really the only place to record because the French didn't quite have it together. But that changed, and he would come over, Serge would come over and be with me while I was recording his songs, because they were not easy. Serge played with words. That was part of his talent, and it wasn't always easy for me.
Can you sing a little bit in French? Because you've already displayed your voice is still very much there.
Oh, dear. Oh, okay, I'll try. Now, this is a song Serge wrote for me called Lagadou, which is sort of like mud, really. Okay, here we go. Du mois de septembre au mois d'août, faudrait des bottes de caoutchouc pour patauger dans Lagadou, 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 ou Lagadou, Lagadou, etc.
What is that about?
Well, it's about walking in the rain, in the mud. Lagadou is sort of like mud or slush, and walking in Wellington boots through it, talking about, well, a couple, you know, we go out and we get caught in the rain and we're walking through the mud. It doesn't sound very glamorous, but no. He had a way of playing with words.
With words, yes.
You know, les gouttes d'eau me dégoulinent dans le dos.
And the words matter to you, don't they? You like a good lyric.
Yes, I do.
Yes.
Yeah.
You've had any number of hits. I was listening to some of your music last night. Couldn't Live Without Your Love.
Oh, I love that song.
And then Don't Sleep in the Subway, huge hit.
Yes, they're my two favourites, I think.
Well, Downtown, I know you probably get sick of talking about it, but there is such... That is ageless. And you recorded a new version of it, didn't you? Relatively recently, I remember that.
Not that recently. Well, it must have been, I mean, a slow version.
The slower version. It was about five or six years ago.
Yes, that's true.
Yeah, something like that. And I like that too.
Good.
But there's a kind of melancholy about it. It's about somebody feeling alone and seeking what exactly?
You know, some people think it's rather a jolly song.
Oh, it's not.
But it's not really.
No.
When you're alone and life is making you lonely, you can always go downtown. Yeah, it's a good lyric. In fact, I first heard it, we were living in Paris by then, and I had a lovely grand piano, which I was very proud of. Serge Gainsbourg spilt beer in it. Which was an interesting moment. But this time...
Did you forgive him?
Tony Hatch, who I had worked with in London, he was a junior record producer. He was recording people like The Searchers, you know, that sort of thing.
Yes.
And I liked him. And he came over to Paris to listen to the new French songs, which we were going to record in London. And it was tea time. So I said, want a cup of tea? He said, yeah, sure. And he said, you know, you really should be recording again in English. I said, well, yes, you know, but I've got my life here. I'm recording in French. I'm on tour. By then I had two small, delightful little girls and recording in Italian and German. He said, no, 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 you should be recording again in English. I said, well, if I could find the right song, why not? He said, well, I've started writing one. I said, I tell you what, you play it on the piano. I'll go and make some tea. And that's when I first heard the music for Downtown. Mm. Whoa, like that. And I came back with a cup of tea.
Yeah.
And I said, if you can write a lyric up to the standard of the melody, I will do it. I said, what's it called? He said, I think I'm going to call it Downtown. Oh, okay. And that was that. And 2 weeks later, we recorded it.
I think it's an amazing song. It's a good song. Yeah, it's a really good song. Clearly not your favourite, but
I like it, but, you know, it's become sort of, it's like a rubber stamp on me, you know.
Okay.
But you look like, oh, that's Downtown.
All right. Can I just ask you about, I mean, everyone name drops in memoirs like yours.
I'm afraid so.
But no, but crikey, Petula, you've met every, I mean, I could not believe it. Charlie, I've just written some names down here. Charlie Chaplin, Dean Martin, Cher, The Carpenters, Barbara Windsor, Percy Edwards. Percy Edwards was someone who I vaguely remember on telly impersonating birds.
Yes,
I think that's him.
And dogs.
And dogs. I mean, but you've met them all. Extraordinary.
I've met them all, yeah.
Well, you have.
Well, yes, that's part of the joy of being in this business. You meet wonderful people, and not just stars, as you mentioned, but you meet great people. You know, just sort of like what you might call ordinary people. They are often the highlights for me.
And home is now Geneva, which is where you spent, I think, lockdown with Claude.
Yes.
Which was difficult for you because, as we've discussed, you'd never really been a domesticated individual.
You could put it that way.
And you say you had to learn quite swiftly.
Well, yes, I got back and it was just Claude and me in this whacking great apartment. So I thought, well, I better go and buy some food. So I went out, bought some food, came back, put it in the kitchen. I thought, now what happens? What do I do now? And I sort of fumbled my way through a meal or two. And then I sort of got the hang of it and actually quite started enjoying it. And after about a month, I thought, well, look, Claude, I think there's a restaurant open down there. Why don't we go? He said, no, no, no. On mange très bien ici. We eat very well here,
yeah,
you know.
Well, thanks to you.
And that was a standing ovation for me. You know, French guy, let's face it.
But I can't imagine what that would have been like. And just very, very briefly, I know you haven't lost your love of performance.
No.
You're not done, are you?
I don't think so. I mean, there's been talk of me doing a concert in London, you know, the Palladium. We've had a couple of times. We've had the Palladium, but we haven't been able to get the rest of it together. It's quite a big thing to organise, and I want to use an orchestra,
yeah,
and I don't have the orchestration, so they are very expensive. So it's quite an expensive thing for one night. So there's been talk of maybe doing 3 nights, maybe going to Manchester, which I would love, Dublin, which I would love. So it might happen.
92 and still very much in the business. Petula Clark's autobiography is called Is That You, Petula? It's out now. You're listening to Fee Glover and Rosie Wright on Times Radio with Wix. Book your free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
The Evening Edition with Kate Borsay on Times Radio with the new Volkswagen California camper van. Embark on an evening expedition, rounding up the latest news and previewing tomorrow's headlines. Plus, don't miss Hit the Road, your essential weekly travel guide to the best destinations across the UK and beyond. The Evening Edition, tonight from 7 on Times Radio with the new Volkswagen California camper van. Designed for every adventure. Search New Volkswagen California to find out more.
Listen to Times Radio on your DAB digital radio.
I'm Adam Vaughan.
environment editor at The Times. And in Planet Hope, we meet the people tackling our biggest environmental and scientific challenges. From saving penguins in Patagonia to helping people with paralysis to move again. These are stories of science, courage, and hope. Follow Planet Hope wherever you get your podcasts. Planet Hope is brought to you by The Times in paid partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative.
In areas overwhelmed by conflicts and natural disasters, we can't miss a life-saving moment. As a doctor with Médecins Sans Frontières, I've seen how a moment lost can mean a life lost. Right now, MSF is working across the globe, providing maternity care, containing outbreaks, performing vital surgeries. We can't miss a life-saving moment. MSF needs help. Your help. Every attack, disease, and natural disaster puts more people at risk and calls for our teams to go further and faster. Medical emergencies move quickly, so must we. Just £30 will keep our work going and make a life or death difference. The life-saving moment is now. To give £30, call 0800 055 7979. That's 0800 055 7979. Or search MSF Urgent. Thank you.
Across the UK, on DAB, online, and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
There's a lot of love that's come in for Petula on the text. Jonathan says, what a fantastic interview. 92, impossible to believe. Fee, I think it's her birthday this week or next week.
On Saturday.
So she'll be 93. There we go. Tony just says, oh, what a lovely lady. And Claire says, can you please tell Petula, I used to call the radio the Down Down, obviously because of how fantastic that song was when I was a toddler. I still love that song.
Life is making you lonely. You can always go downtown.
When thank you, Ryan.
Worries, all the noise and the hurry seems to help, I know. Downtown.
Well, she's not wrong either, is she? I mean, I think 1 in 10 people who are travelling to a shopping centre aren't intending to do any retail action at all. They just want to get out of the house. We completely sympathise. Rosie, it's been such a pleasure having you on the afternoon show this week. You are back.
Tomorrow morning. At 5 a.m. So if you are an early riser, I will join you then. Thank you for having me this week.
And I'm sure that you'll be back in the afternoon sometime soon as well. Just to whet your appetite, Jane Garvey returns on Monday. We've got a fabulous lineup of guests for you next week. We've got Sam Seacombe, who is an investment expert. We've got Dame Susan Langley, who is the current Lady Mayor of London, and Lord Mark Price. We are festooned with the honours next week. He is the former boss of Waitrose and he's now in charge of Fair Trade as well. So plenty to talk to him about too. Have a very lovely weekend when you get to it. John Pienaar is up next. We need to say thank you as ever to our producer today, Felix Forbes, Hannah Quinn as well, and our technical operator was Ryan Boyden.
Across the UK, on DAB digital radio, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Thank you, Fee. Thank you, Rosie. At 4 o'clock, I'm John Pienaar, and this is Times Radio Drive. Here are the headlines. A report has cited racial sensitivity as a reason the abuse of 10-year-old Sara Sharif wasn't uncovered before her father and stepmother went on to kill her. And the Health Secretary, Wes Streetings, described rumours about a leadership coup as a silly Westminster soap opera. Coming up, we're going to take a closer look at what's going wrong in Number 10 and if the Prime Minister's Chief of Staff, Morgan McSweeney, is in the firing line. And I'll be talking to the Belarusian opposition leader, Svetlana Tikhanovskaya.
This is Times Radio.
And now the news with Stuart Willey.
John, thank you. Good afternoon. A report into the death of Sara Sharif, murdered by her father and stepmother in Surrey, has found racial sensitivity was one reason her abuse wasn't uncovered. The independent review concluded she was failed by the safeguarding system, finding numerous missed opportunities to save her. The 10-year-old girl was found dead in 2023 when her father called police after fleeing to Pakistan. Baroness Spellman, Amanda Spellman, is a former chief inspector of education. She told Times Radio authorities need a stronger focus on the interests of children.
There's an optimism in public policy that families are fixable. And yet, with families like this, where both the father and the stepmother have such long histories, the father in particular, of domestic abuse, I do worry that the current direction of policy is back towards the optimistic, we can fix every family.
The Prime Minister says anonymous briefings over a leadership coup did not come from Number 10. Sir Keir Starmer has faced calls from ministers to sack those behind rumours his health secretary was plotting a leadership coup. An investigation has wrapped up hours after it began. The Prime Minister called such briefings completely unacceptable.
Whether it's this case or any other, I intend to deal with it. I will absolutely deal with anybody responsible for briefing against ministers, cabinet ministers or other ministers. I've always said that's the standard that I expect and that's the standard that I will enforce.
Police and crime commissioners in England and Wales are to be scrapped by the government. The elected officials set budgets and appoint chief constables. Ministers insist £100 million worth of savings will be invested into more neighbourhood policing. But Shadow Home Secretary Chris Philpe says that won't scratch the surface.
This government, essentially, in their announcement today, is tinkering around the edges. They are rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic, while crimes like shoplifting rocket, while police numbers fall, and while the police face a funding crisis made in the Home Office.
A police officer who drove his motorcycle into an 81-year-old woman has been found not guilty of causing death by careless driving. Metropolitan Police motorcyclist Christopher Harrison was escorting the Duchess of Edinburgh through London when the fatal crash happened in 2023. Economic growth has slowed to 0.1% in the third quarter in a fresh blow to the Chancellor. The worse-than-expected data from the Office for National Statistics indicates the worst performance in nearly 2 years, partly driven by a fall in car making at Jaguar Land Rover after a cyber attack. They're the last official GDP figures before the budget. And there are warnings flooding could hit parts of the UK tomorrow as the Met Office issues an amber warning for rain. Storm Claudia will bring heavy downpours and strong winds for much of the country. For a roundup of the news on demand, find the Times News Briefing on the Times Radio app.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app, online and on your smart speaker. Quality journalism, analysis and opinion that speaks for itself. John Pienaar at Drive on Times Radio.
Hello, I'm John Pienaar with Times Radio Drive. It's good to have your company. What was that old cliche about a week being a long time in politics? And Keir Starmer's week started so well, by which I mean only averagely miserable, with cabinet colleagues reminding him the coming budget could be a political disaster. And now look, today it's pretty much received wisdom that Starmer's days in Number 10 are numbered, not if, just when. It's commonly perceived the Prime Minister runs his government, and so the country, from deep within a Downing Street defensive bunker, wholly reliant on his closest advisers, by which I mean Morgan McSweeney. And worse, it's common currency that Keir Starmer is clueless about politics, lacking any defining vision or ability to communicate it, even if he had one. And the worst thing by far, well, suddenly, this isn't just the word in the Westminster bubble among MPs and the political commentariat. You'll hear it in the local pub, at the school gate, and the bus stop down the road, and the Prime Minister's Downing Street team can thank themselves for that, after telling a chain of senior journalists their boss was determined to take on and beat any challenger for his job, and throwing in the name of the Health Secretary, Wes Streeting, for some extra edge. The question today, then, for Keir Starmer, for his ministers and for MPs, what to do about it? What's the solution? Assuming there even is one. And there may not be. Any ideas? Send me a text, 87222. Start with the word Times. Or maybe a tweet to @TimesRadio. Keir Starmer, he has been speaking in North Wales after announcing the UK's first small modular reactor. Prime Minister insists no one from Downing Street briefed against the Health Secretary, Wes Streeting.
I've been talking to my team today. I've been assured that no briefing against ministers was done from Number 10, but I've made it clear that I find it absolutely unacceptable.
Now, the Health Secretary said that he's looking to move past the backlash to anonymous briefings.
One of the great things about being here in the Northwest today is I can leave all the trivial Westminster bubble stuff behind and instead focus on what we are doing, which is the change the public voted for.
Now, Wes Streeting, I can talk now. We can hear from George Parker, the Financial Times political editor. Hi to you, George.
Hi, John.
Hi, and Matthew Torbett here, the former Labour advisor. Hello, Matt.
Hi, John.
Guys, let me ask you both this. I mean, it is, I guess, fair to call this a crisis for Keir Starmer. Do you believe the bungled operation by his team this week requires action, whether it's changes at number 10, whether it's a change in the way that Starmer leads? George, can I ask you that first?
I think yes. I mean, it's an incredible achievement, isn't it? You launch a briefing operation intended to strengthen the Prime Minister, and you end up plunging him into a leadership crisis that hardly anybody in the real world thought existed. So yes, I mean, look, there are some serious questions to be answered about the way the number 10 operation works and how anyone could launch such a briefing operation. Alistair Campbell, Tony Blair's former spin doctor, said it was about as bad a mistake as you could possibly have. I think I can see what they were trying to do. They were trying to flush out the plotters, but it was too clever by half. And, you know, the problem, I think, is, though, that if Keir Starmer clears out number 10, well, he's always clearing out number 10. And the problem is he doesn't bring in anyone better to do the jobs people he's replaced.
But does that mean, George, he should again clear out number 10 and maybe bring in better people? Is that what you're saying?
Well, I mean, certainly they need to look at how this briefing operation went wrong. And there's been a lot of focus on the role of Morgan McSweeney, Keir Starmer's chief of staff, who is a lightning rod for criticism of the Prime Minister. But in the end, I think you have to look at the whole operation. He's recently brought in a new head of communications, Tim Allen, who used to work with Alistair Campbell there, who you know, you think might have spotted the pitfalls of advertising the Prime Minister's weakness in a series of briefings to newspapers saying that a leadership contest was in the offing.
Yeah. Matthew, your thoughts?
I agree largely with George. I think we all know how these things work. And unfortunately, to keep a largely unhappy, or as it was described in the Times, feral PLP happy, there will have to be somewhat of a sacrificial lamb. And I don't think there will be... This can't be junior staff. This can't be blamed on anybody else. You would have to sack Morgan McSweeney. Unfortunately, the Prime Minister has already initiated. He's not prepared to do that. One, I imagine, because he is his ideological brain. And in a way, I think he owes him so much to getting him to where he is, because I don't think he's got the strategic nous to have been able to have done this on his own or with another member of staff. And I think, therefore, his days are numbered. You asked